Kof Adar, Wednesday the 14th of March, Rabbi Dr. Svi Belovsky. A different spin on Techeles, Reb Chaim and scientific discovery. Today's shiur is sponsored Lechvod, Lechasna of Shmuley Vorhand and Racheli Friedman.
Morning. I want to talk a little about a subject that I suspect has been addressed here before. Talk about Techeles. I know that the Razila Rebbe has spoken in this forum about this subject. And I apologise if there's any duplication, but I suspect that I'll speak about something rather different. The subject of Techeles is one of the great mysteries, enigmas of Jewish history and halacha. It's clear that the Torah has a use for Techeles. It's been seasonal. Techeles is mentioned several times in this week's Parsha, but in a context which is not relevant in the non-Beis HaMikdash era. However, there is, of course, the use of Techeles intended. Since it's Pesil Techeles, the requirement to include Techeles in the Tzitzis. There are various versions of what exactly happened. It's clear the Gemara, so already by the beginning of the 6th century, the Gemara knows of Techeles, discusses Techeles as though it were a real entity, but is aware that it's hard to get hold of, it's expensive, there are plenty of charlatans passing off alternatives. Techeles is of course made from the secretion of the chilozin, some kind of secret, to be discussed in a moment. And in Talmudic and pre-Talmudic times, it was clear that this kila ilon, which is indigo, which is a vegetable-based blue dye, which looks much the same, easily available, cheap, and to the untrained eye, indistinguishable from the real thing, was prevalent, and all kinds of tests are provided by the Gemara. You wash it in this material, you scrub it with this, in order to determine whether what you have is in fact an indelible type of ink used for dye, which would work as which is real Techeles. It's clear then by the beginning of the 6th century, this substance has been rare, and clearly in lots of places they don't have it. The Mishnah even formulates that in the 2nd century. The awareness that you may not have Techeles, and discusses whether the Techeles is ma'ake the lovan, meaning that if you've only got white strings, is it worth making the tzitzis at all? Can you mekayim the mitzvah? The conclusion, of course, is that you can, otherwise there will be no mitzvah in the non-Techeles era. Probably what happened is that given the value of such dyes, the Roman Empire restricted their import and export transportation, restricted them to specific markets, and the result was over a period of time due to dispersal, oppression, and the scarcity of the product anyway, it's died out, if you'll pardon the pun. There are reports of people having Techeles until about the 10th century, but they're probably not right. The likelihood is that by the 6th or 7th century, Techeles is unavailable. And since then, we have observed the mitzvah of tzitzis using simply the white strings. Now, all of this began to look rather different in the mid-19th century. Mid-19th century, actually in the late 1850s, there's some interesting research, non-Jewish research, which produces a suggestion that some of the dyes that were known in Roman times came from a certain type of snail. The snail's called Murex trunculus. And independent of that, in the 1870s and 1880s, the Radzina Rebbe, the illustrious ancestor who became known as the Bala Techeles because of his discoveries, even though he wrote many more significant works, Radzina Rebbe, there's Gershon Henoch Lena, for me, of more interest because he's the grandson of the Ishbitzer and the publisher of the writings of the Ishbitzer. But in this regard, he became known because he conducted a scientific discovery, a scientific research project. And it's fascinating. He writes eventually three monographs on the subject of Techeles, two published in his lifetime, and one published after he died. You have to get the jokes. So after he, posthumously, if he's any funny ones, then don't you? Okay. And he determines that even though no one has used Techeles for perhaps 1,300 years, or even if it's more recent, 800-900 years, there's a mitzvah of the Torah that's used to pay this, and if it were possible to discover the appropriate substance and methodology, there would be a mitzvah, and in fact would be incumbent upon anyone who could do it, who could find it, to use it. And he begins to discuss the subject, and he gives there's a wonderful vignette in which he describes what he did. He discusses that he'd been brought various samples of aquatic creatures for him to examine. There are all kinds of Gemaras. We'll perhaps just spend a moment before we look at what the Ravzina writes. One or two sources. The evidence is, there's plenty of rushes as Gemara Shabbos. There isn't really time to discuss the sources in great detail. But what comes out of the basic sources is that the chilozon is a sea creature. It's rare. And we have this wonderful image of this of these creatures that appear once in 70 years. But it can't mean they only appear once in 70 years, because the Gemara in Shabbos describes a trade, people called Yogvin, who were chilozon divers. They must have not made a good parnosa if they were only available once in 70 years. You know, they said, well, it might fall on the Shabbos, so they just didn't get them that time. So you've got to wait another 70 years. So clearly it means they only emerge in large numbers every 70 years. All the 70 years is a kind of a euphemism for an infrequent arrival. But they clearly were available. They are clearly available Misulomis Shel Tzura V'Av Haifa, which means from the Tyrian steppes to Haifa. So they appear on the Mediterranean coast of Eretz Israel. And various other sources, there is, interestingly, there is a braisa, Hatzad Chilozon V'Hapoitza'oi. It's in Shabbos Daf Ayin Hey. Someone traps a chilozon, and is discussing what chiyuvim are attend this act on Shabbos. Somebody traps a chilozon, upoitzoi, which means to burst it open. It means to crack it open, which would seem to indicate that the chilozon has a hard shell. It's not a fish. I remember when I was a kid, there were people who were suggesting that it was really the coelacanth, which was a fish believed to have been extinct for a long time and have been discovered in deep waters early in the 20th century. That doesn't fit this at all. It's not a coelacanth. And it seems, as the Midrash in Shia Shirim would suggest, that the chilozon has a shell. In fact, it refers to it. Remember this, the idea that the clothes, simlosachol lo bolchom eolecho, the clothes grew with them, the cloudy soil, in the desert. The comparison is made in the Midrash to a snail, a chilozon, where the shell grows with it. It appears to be a snail of some sort. And it's a sea creature. There are certain texts about its colour, about its behaviour, and so on. And on the basis of these sources, the Ravzina Rebbe, in the sort of 1870s, 1880s, takes upon himself this research project. And he starts by receiving various samples. He lives in the shtetl in Poland, and they're not very near where these things will be available. There's no way of getting them alive. So he recognises that he has limited powers of research if all he can get is dead samples. So he decides to go to Italy. And he goes off to Italy. Apparently, he quite well in disguise, but he didn't dress, he didn't take his pelts and his strimal and his whole entourage with him. He went off reasonably incognito, and he describes that I went to Ubonu Ligvul Yam Hatichoin. We went to the edge of the Mediterranean, Bemedinas Italia Beir Neapoli. We went to Italy, to Naples. Why do you go to Naples in the 1880s if you're a god? Because what?
To Naples
and done. Okay, right. I should be quiet. Because there were the greatest aquaria of that time. That's where the research will be conducted. And he describes. He describes something which in his audience in Poland would never have imagined, which is an aquarium. And he describes you've got this great construction that's built under the ground, and it's filled with seawater, and there's a glass front, and you can see the things in their natural habitat. Something which, I mean, you just write, it's an aquarium. But it's just interesting to see that his audience probably couldn't imagine what this was. So he describes it in great detail, in these little rooms that are built from glass under the ground, and he describes. In the meantime, he recognises that this is the place to conduct the research. He stays there for several months. And I understand he actually went there three or four times. These days you just get on a train, but it was probably a reasonable schlep, although he was able to go by train. He went there a few times, and he comes to a conclusion. After a few months of research, writing, discussion with scientists, he comes to the conclusion that the chilozen is a cuttlefish, the tinkta fish, as he calls it, which is what it was known as, it seems, in his Yiddish in Poland. It comes to the conclusion it's a cuttlefish, which is a small brand of squid. We know what cuttlefish are because it's that white thing. It has an inside like a hard bone type substance, which is used in bird cages so that the bird can keep its beak sharp. Have you ever seen like a budgie cage? They have a sort of like a white flat thing which is stuck in the bars of the cage for the budgie to sharpen its beak on. That's the inside of a cuttlefish. They were well known, not difficult to obtain. He goes back to Rudzin. He consults with scientists. How do you make a blue dye out of this fish? And he gets some advice from scientists. You have to mix it with this, and you have to do this to it, and you have to boil it at high temperature in this way. And by the mid-1880s, he opens a Techeles factory in Radzin, and he begins to produce Techeles made from the secretion of the cuttlefish. This is adopted by the Radzin. Is quite big, he has quite a lot of followers, and there are various other people, including Breslov, who become quite keen on this, and it becomes reasonably popular. He dies in the late 1880s, and the manufacture of Radzin Techeles dye continues. In the meantime, and we'll do this quite quickly, quite a number of people don't like this. Most notably, the Briskers. He writes to the person he refers to as the Gorn of Basin of Brisk in Litta, and there is a correspondence. There is a correspondence. And the Beis HaLevi, I called it Reb Chaim on things that fit it better, but the Beis HaLevi does not like this and rejects it. And the Radziner is not to be deterred, and he argues with him, and there is a record of some of the correspondence according to his understanding of the objections in his Sefer Ein HaTecheles. In a moment, we'll discuss these objections and what we think about them, but it's quite clear that the majority of Torah scholars did not accept that it was appropriate to adopt the way of use of Techeles. So let's consider those. Let's just finish the history story. In the period around the beginning of the First World War, Rav Herzog, who was at the time the chief rabbi in Ireland, and later became the chief rabbi in Eretz Israel, he had a background in chemistry, and he developed an interest in this. And he wrote what was, I think, a doctoral thesis on the subject, in which he demonstrated, and this was really his thesis, that the Radzin Techeles was mistaken. He communicated with the Radzin people, they were still making Techeles, according to the Radzin method. This is about 1913, just before the First World War. He writes and he communicates with them, and he proves that the Radziner Rebbe has been duped, either by someone unscrupulous or unwittingly, because the dye that he is manufacturing is not blue because of something in the squid, the cuttlefish's secretion, but because of the iron filings and other stuff which is added, and the process that is used to produce what is Prussian blue, a blue colouring, could be made from any organic material using the same method. And therefore, Herzog claims to have demonstrated that this cannot be the true chilozen from which the blue dye has to be extracted by a more natural means. Because if you add blue things, you can make anything blue by adding blue substance to it. Nonetheless, despite this reputation, the Radzins continue. Historically, it's very interesting. The Radzin method and their things were destroyed in the war. And after the war, the remnants of the Radzin Hasidim wanted to recreate the Techeles manufacturing process according to the Rebbe's instructions, but everything had been lost. So how do they find out what to do? They read Herzog's thesis, because Herzog's thesis describes their method, details the correspondence with the Radzin Dai master, and it's true, explains why he thinks it's wrong. They were able to use Herzog's writings to recreate the Radzin Dai method, even though it would appear that Herzog had successfully refuted it. What happens then, is that Herzog is of the view that it is probably the Murex truncula snail, which is a type of snail from which there is, which we would crack open at a certain place to extract the dye sac, and by a certain method, he didn't know how to produce a blue dye from it, and also the colour of the shell. Which the shells that he received didn't seem to match the description in Chazal. It was later discovered that the shells he'd received had been polished from all the muck that you get on in the sea, and what it is going on in the Gomorrah. They're describing it as they appear naturally, with the kind of mess that they get on from the sea, what's called sea fouling, and the sea fouling gives it a blue hue, which then conforms, and so in the meantime Herzog identifies it as a different snail. Whether he ever made it or just theoretical, it's not really clear. It was a doctoral thesis rather than a halachic guidebook. Subsequent research, archaeology, have discovered enormous numbers of dye pits around on the Mediterranean coast in Eretz Israel, in other places, traces of dye which seem to indicate very strongly other discoveries, and about 30 years ago, the discovery of a quite simple process by which, if you heat the dye that can be extracted from the snail, and you oxidize it in a certain way, you expose it to a certain amount of sunlight, you can produce, in a very simple method, without really any additives, the kind of blue dye that appears to be described in Chazal, and Rishonim using the same kind of method and producing the same kind of colour. By the way, in Rishonim there's quite a wide spectrum of what the colour might actually look like, and so on, but that's really incidental. And that's really where the research is taken. It seems very probable, based on numerous disciplines, scientific discovery, comparison of the dye produced from the Murex truncula snail and the dyes that have been found in traces in pits from the Roman period, when we knew that the Yidden in Eretz Yisrael had Techeles and so on. It all matches up very well, and it seems very probable that the correct identification has been made. What I'm interested in now is, that's very nice, that's the historical background, and some people have adopted it and some people have not adopted it. Well, on what basis should one not adopt this? It's a very interesting question. What the Beis Halevi, as Reb Chaim, are saying, and this is discussed in the Ein Techeles, Ein HaTecheles of the Radzina, and it's also mentioned by Rav Soloveitchik from YU, who was the great grandson of the Beis Halevi. He writes about this machlokas between his great grandfather and the Radzina Rebbe, and what comes out of this are really two versions of what exactly the Beis Halevi, Reb Chaim Brisker, what were their problem with it? What's the problem? It would seem to be a no-brainer. If the Techeles Eino Ma'akeves Es HaLovon, meaning, if you haven't got Techeles, you can wear Lovon, and by the other way as well, if you haven't got Lovon, you can wear only Techeles, but that seems a rather improbable outcome, because you'd have had to dye the strings to get the Techeles in the first place. So if you haven't got them, if you haven't got the Techeles, you could still have the white. It's not likely to be the other way around. And what could be lost by wearing it? What's the worst thing? The worst thing is that the Techeles you have is not real Techeles, it's something else. And so it would seem that when the Gemara, the Mishnah in Menachos, and the Sugya discussing the Mishnah refers to Lovan, it doesn't mean white, it means not Techeles, probably. And therefore the worst thing is, you end up with strings which are all Lovan, even though some of them are blue, they're just not Techeles. The best thing is you're mekayem the mitzvah as the Torah requires it, and the worst thing is you're not any worse off than you were before. It depends. There is a reading of the Rambam. The Rambam has a very interesting chiddush in Knof Min Knof, meaning that the tzitzis have to resemble, the understanding of the Gemara is that the tzitzis are supposed to be made of the same material as the Beged. The Rambam holds that's made of the same colour. So it goes on, if you for some reason decide to wear a pink beged, you should have pink tzitzis on the pink beged, which is a further raya that pink, that loven doesn't mean white, it means not to peles. So it could be, and you'd have to read the Rambam a particular way, that if you had non-tefeles strings that are blue, now your beged is not the same colour as your tzitzit, and perhaps you're not mekayem the mitzvah. But it's quite a narrow, specific way of reading. But what's the problem? What's the problem? Why not do this? So as I said, there are two versions cited of the Brisker's objections to this. One is as follows, and this is pretty much what Rav Soloveitchik says. And this closes the matter off completely. But it's just very interesting that one could say such a thing. To identify anything, chelozim included, one needs a masorah. There's no masorah. The masorah was lost at a certain point. In the 6th century or a little later, whenever it was, the masorah was lost. We know that there was a time when they had techeles, and they knew what it was, and the discussion just making sure you use it properly, and you're not duped by someone unscrupulous who said you're a fake. But they knew what techeles was. That masorah was lost. You can't invent a masorah. Even if there is conclusive, persuasive, scientific, or other archaeological evidence. Which means even if you're right, you're not right. Which is a very interesting way of thinking. That's one version. If that is exactly, as Rav Soloveitchik suggests, his great-grandfather's objection, there's nowhere to go. At some point, a Novi might be able to reintroduce some kind of Masorah, but until such time, there's nothing you can do. The Torah requires you to do it, but you can't do it because there's no Masorah. There's another version, and this apparently, according to Rav Eliashiv, apparently is a more likely, explanation, because it seems very interesting. I would say, if I dare argue with that, there is no Masorah not to wear this to wear techeles. All that happened was that it became impossible because it wasn't available. There's no masorah that this fish isn't or this fish is. It just so happens that there was no possibility of doing it. There's never been a masorah not to wear techeles. There's just been, not been impossible. It's an ikuv. You haven't got the thing. If you haven't got a lulav, you can't shake lulav. And so on. And it seems a very interesting suggestion that there's an opportunity to do the mitzvah. It seems very likely that it's identified correctly. It's probable there's nothing lost halachically, even if it's the wrong thing. And yet, because there's no masorah, you shouldn't do it. The alternative is, and this perhaps seems more credible, apparently, Mipi Hashmua Rav Eliashiv says this is probably the nature of the objection, is that the Beis Halevi said that actually, there is a masorah that the cuttlefish is not the chilozim. How do you know? Because the cuttlefish is well known in places where Jews live. It's well known in Europe. It's well known in all kinds of places. It is well known in places in Europe. It's not some rarity that no one knows. It's not some rarity. And as such, since the cuttlefish is well known in places where Jews have lived throughout the centuries, it's easily available in lots of places, that is tantamount to a masorah that it's not the cuttlefish. And therefore, it's repudiated not on the basis of a lack of masorah or the impossibility of creating a masorah without some kind of intervention from a Novi, but it's rejected on the fact that we know it's not the cuttlefish because it's something which has been known for centuries. Everyone knows the cuttlefish. It was well known. And as such, it's tantamount to there not being a masorah that it's not the cuttlefish. Of course, that version of the Beis Halevi's objection allows for the possibility that if persuasive evidence was produced that the chilozin is actually something that was not known in European Jewry at least, and perhaps in Sephardi Jewry as well, this was not available, it was not known, it was inaccessible, and in places where people were dispersed, it would have been, not have been known. There would have been centuries and centuries, perhaps millennia even, for some parts of world Jewry, where they would not have known of this, they would have heard it, they would never have seen it. If you lived on the Mediterranean coast, you'd probably eat this for breakfast, right? And in fact, that's often what they did. The snail, they took out the dye sack, they ate the snail, and they used the dye sack for as a, the snail's a snack, and the dye sack was used for dyeing.
We don't eat snails, but
I'm talking about where they produce. Where they're produced in Mediterranean countries, snails are on the menu. Not the local people, not Jews. No, not Jews. No, I knew that. Fine.
He's a rabbi, isn't he?
Right, I knew that. I remember something from Gateshead. Okay. And so this alternative version allows for the possibility that scientific or archaeological discovery could impact on halakhic norms. And so I suppose that the discussion now moves to, if you adopt the original, the version that Rav Soloveitchik says was the Beis HaLevi's objection, there's nothing to talk about. Even if you're right, you're not right. Because even if it's right, and it's not a refutation of the veracity of the scientific or archaeological development, you just can't do it anyway, because the Masorah does not allow it. I.e., the system is quite rigid, and it's rigid to the extent that even if you have persuasive evidence that you can now perform a mitzvah deraisa in a way that could not have been performed for 1,500 years, you can't do it anyway. It's a very, very extreme position, if you think about it. An amazing opportunity arises, and the sense of restoration of a mitzvah, a renaissance of a mitzvah that's been lost for 1,500 years... And yet, you can't do it because there's no Masorah. And that is in Shirim Lezecha Abba Moiri, which is a collection of essays by Rav Soloveitchik in memory of his father. That is what he says in his essay on synthesis. Was his great-grandfather the Beis HaLevi's objection? And why he himself did not adapt to wearing tefillin? Because his Masorah like that. Apparently, the other version, this is the version I think the Radzina understood, and according to those who talk about it, apparently Rav Lyoshev says, is more likely to have been the Beis HaLevi's objection, is to do with the wrong identification. If it's something which is well known, then it cannot be that, because if it's a well-known fish, or well-known, it's been well-known where Jews live, that's tantamount to almost so that it's not that. But that allows much greater flexibility, and therefore it is possible, according to that understanding of the Beis HaLevi's objection, that were the modern research to be available, he would admit the possibility that, not that there's no Masorah, but we don't have to have, that since we don't have a Masorah, that it isn't the snail, one could accommodate it. And that's what I meant in the title of the Shia, that there really appears to be a much more interesting in me than perhaps the very narrow issue about Tacheles. Two streams of thought about whether the system is flexible enough. Obviously, in order to introduce something to the halakhic system, you've got to be very persuasive. He's going to have to match all the criteria. Chazal, we're not talking about spurious or unpersuasive innovation. Here we're talking about something which is rooted in numerous sources. All of the sources fit this very well. The history fits it. The descriptions fit it. The archaeology fits it. The science fits it. It fits extremely well. It's very, very difficult to refute. Of course, there are always going to be counter-arguments. One of the counter-arguments, for those who are interested, is that this method of extracting a dye from the Murex truncula snail also determines that the Argomon purple dye, which has no use in the non-temple era, unlike Tacheles, which is used in Sitsis, would be made from the same snail, but just there's a different degree of oxidation. The process is different. Now, there are those who say, no, it can't be that. They must be from a different animal. And since Argomon must be from a different animal, and you're suggesting it can't be from the same animal, well, then your Tacheles can't be Tacheles either. That's one of the technical arguments against it. We're not saying it's watertight. But it would seem that the decision whether or not one should adopt this, given the opportunity to fulfil the mitzvah deraisa k'tikuno, really lies in this discussion as to whether the system has enough flexibility to accommodate, albeit based on persuasive evidence, that it's non-masoretic evidence. It is evidence from alternative sources, from archaeology, from scientific discovery, from research. Clearly the Radzina Rebbe, who was no mean halachist, so you know he wrote this in Taurus, I mean he's really a very serious halachist, was of the view that assuming that one could identify the min correctly, then you could certainly include it. In fact, he writes you have an obligation. In fact, he says even further, with which I'll finish. He says that the Mishnah that says that the Techeles and Lavan are not interdependent, and therefore in the absence of Techeles one can wear Lavan tzitzis, is obviously only discussing a situation where you don't have Techeles, or an opportunity to wear Techeles. He says, if you have Techeles, then the Mishnah doesn't start, and it could be that you're not Mekayim the Mitzvah. Good morning. Could be.